You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 163, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today's expert is really great. It's Chris Deacon, who managed within the New Jersey state government to save billions of dollars within their health and benefits plan. She actually reformed government from the inside. This is something that I oftentimes think is not possible, but she proves me wrong. So we're going to talk about what she did, how she did it, the roadblocks she faced, and how that translates into maybe the broader healthcare discussion and as far as funding goes for the rest of the country. That means not just state governments, but we're talking about federal and potentially large businesses and even small businesses and how they can transform their healthcare and save money. And maybe if you're someone who's interested in getting involved in government, actually reforming it to make it work better for the people, perhaps today's conversation will provide that spark and inspiration that you need. Show notes can be found, as always, at theparadox.com/163. Finally, I'd encourage you, if you've not yet subscribed to the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast player, whatever you're listening to it now, and also leave a written review. Those are greatly appreciated, as is the fact that you continue to share the show with your friends and recommend it to your colleagues and family members, and it's, again, greatly appreciated. But without further ado, how I reformed state government and saved billions of dollars with Chris Deacon. Enjoy. Welcome. I'm here with my new friend, Kristen Deacon. Chris Deacon is at 4C Health Solutions, but she formerly was the Deputy Attorney General of New Jersey and then served as special counsel to the governor in the Christie administration. She then moved on to a role as Assistant Director of the Division of Pension and Benefits, and that, which is actually kind of a lousy tease, we're going to talk about pensions and benefits here, which I'm sure people are on the edge of their seat, but it's actually a really great story. So Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I tend to be very libertarian, and so it's very easy for me to be cynical about government and how government is hopeless and it's a money pit. And, you know, you send a dollar taxes, you'd be thankful if you get 10 cents worth of value back from the government. So that's sort of my approach in looking at these things, and that no one is in government is working to improve that situation. You know, everyone's got their interest in perpetuating the current system, and they've got their players, you know, supporters. So why don't you tell us your story? Because I think it's really fascinating. Sure. Before I set up too much and explain away, I want you to tell me what you did in pensions and benefits in New Jersey, because I think it's a really great story.
Yeah, great. I'll start by saying I didn't really grow up in healthcare. I'm a lawyer by training, as you mentioned, and I was actually a bankruptcy attorney who practiced in Delaware, PA, and New Jersey for several years before finding myself in public service. Like you said, first as a deputy attorney general and then in the governor's office. And that was really my first foray into the healthcare world, as I oversaw Department of Banking and Insurance, and also dealt with some of the hospitals in the state. When I went to the treasurer's office at Division of Pensions and Benefits, I had the opportunity, like the incredible opportunity, to run, you know, one of the largest health plans in the country, both public and private sector. We had about 820,000 members as of the time that I left. So we're a mega player. And, you know, it was a tremendous learning experience. It was humbling. It was eye-opening. And, you know, I totally appreciate the perspective that you bring, you know, having come from the private sector and then joined public sector. You know, it was, I wouldn't say it was, you know, I was one of few people in that breed that, you know, comes at it with a lot of energy and throws everything they have, you know, also happen to throw a global pandemic into the mix while I was running a mega health plan. But I think that by and large, many public servants really do want to do the right thing for the taxpayers and for government entities. But some of the systems that are in place just really make that difficult. And whether it's the really laborious process of public procurement or, you know, just some of the rules that are put in place, you know, sort of rule, you know, making rules to the lowest common denominator amongst us really sort of puts your hands behind your back. That being said, I will say that some of the challenges the public sector sort of saddled us with, right? So couldn't change plan design because we had labor contracts that couldn't be touched, couldn't engage in cost shifting because of the political dynamic. Like some of these things that the typical chief human resource officer or benefits person would say, well, without these tools, I don't know what to do to control costs. They forced us to get really creative. So more creative procurement methodology. We engaged in a reverse auction to basically put the vendors against each other and come to us with best price as opposed to sort of going in blind. We also engaged in a RFP process and evaluation process based on unit cost guarantees as opposed to a discount analysis, which if you've been in the healthcare industry, you know, discounts are the thing that most people use, and a discount off a number I don't know is meaningless to me.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, just it did force us to get more creative, but I think that that led to some really innovative thinking and ultimately some really great results in the state, having saved over the 3 years that we were there, you know, well over $2 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars in healthcare costs and pharmaceutical costs.
So specifically, I mean, well, you mentioned the process there, but how do you go about tackling it? Because you have stakeholders is the term we use in government, right?
Like yes.
There's the people who provide it, the people who receive it, and the people who are in the middle, you know, and how do you manage all that to get people to accept it? I mean, because I feel like a lot of, is this not because it's legislative action, it's executive. And so you sort of can set the rules for how you want to work the process, or is this something you have to go to the legislature, ask for permission and to do certain processes right. Or because those are obviously some of the constraints you have to deal with, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of constraints, you know, the public procurement process itself is just this monolith of, you know, had to go through 9 agencies just to get the RFP out the door. Right. So some of them took some legislative cooperation, for example, the reverse auction process. In order to unmask prices and really get, you know, a competitive bidding process going, where the bidders were trying to outbid the other, we had to get legislation because in a public procurement process, you can't unmask prices typically. Okay. And then, you know, on our TPA contract, for example, we worked with Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey. In that instance, it was a matter of really aggressive management of the contract and management to the terms of a really smart contract. We precluded cross-plan offsetting. We, put strict terms on when, if claims were adjusted, when they needed to be returned to the self-funded plan, requiring segregation of accounts, payment on checks cleared basis only. So some of the things they didn't, again, it didn't require necessarily a consumer facing engagement. It didn't require, it was really some really hard work and prudent oversight of some of the systems we already had in place.
Yeah. And it's so easy to get caught lingo. So I was just like, what's TPA? Oh, TPA is third party administrator, right? I mean,
yes.
And so that's the person who takes your claims and processes them, right?
Yeah. I mean, so we used, our model was to have a carrier that had, you know, obviously we're self-funded at 820,000 people. Our model was a carrier and TPA. So we would rent our network was provided by Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they also were our claims adjudicator. So we used, you know, as most large public entity use, it's one of the BUCAs, Blue Cross, United, Cigna, Aetna. And, but we were self-funded. So all of the risk and all of, you know, the claims paid were coming out of the state's health benefits fund.
And how do you, so one of the, when I talk to people about, when it comes to self-funding, one of the drawbacks to self-funding is you definitely take on a lot of risk, or you take on some risk in the process, but it's hard to sometimes get the benefits because you rely on the contracts with your third party administrator or the network. Right. And those contracts are oftentimes not very good. And right. They're, and I always give the example. I've given the example in my show before. I had a test that was $250 cash if I wanted to get it, or I could ask my insurance. I said, I'll just put through insurance, whatever, because I had a deductible or something. And I pay, I think, the last 10% on the deductible. And I got a bill for $5,000. So my 10% would be 500. I'm like twice what I would have to have paid if my insurance accepted that. And so, and that's for the exact same test, right? So, I mean, that was like a 200% markup, which you're, most people I tell this to, they're amazed. You're just like, yeah, okay. You're used to that sort of markup. So how do you get around that problem? How do you save this, the state money when you risk, you know, when you're basically on the backs of these kind of lousy contracts with the carriers?
Yeah. I mean, we have to do a better job with our contracts. You know, one of the things I did have the benefit of with the way that our contracting process works in the state, you know, we drafted and crafted the contract and it doesn't change, right? It's not like we find a bidder and they bid on the business, they give us a price and then we negotiate terms. The terms of the contract are set by us. So like I said, no cross plan offsetting.
What does that mean?
So in the TPA carrier world, often what happens, and you're a doctor, you've probably, you know, you're a physician, you've seen this, you get paid by the insurance company $1,000 for a claim, right? Sure. And then 6 months later or 2 months later, they decide that you didn't really earn, or, you know, we're going to downward adjust, right? And I'm going to take half of it back. And now you only get $500 for that exact same claim, right? Well, in order to, they're adjusting that claim, but they're not going to ask you to, like, you know, issue a check. They're just going to offset on a future payment, right?
I got you. Mm-hmm.
But what a cross plan offset does is it essentially, it's taking, let's say that first claim was my member and I'm a self-funded health plan. That's my money, right? That's not Blue Cross Blue Shield's money. That's my money. They're just the facilitator. Well, if they take that money back, that $500 back from you, and they make another plan whole before me, that's a breach of my fiduciary obligation because that's my money. Gotcha. And so cross plan offsetting is this process that a few circuits have deemed it illegal because you're taking an ERISA funded, you know, self-funded plan money, and you're using it to make your fully insured business whole, which is typically what happens, or you're using my money to make some other employer whole, you know, based on a claim with you, the doctor. So precluding cross plan offsetting. Another area that we improved this last round was lesser of logic. So lesser of the bill charge or the negotiated amount. So we actually saw in one claim outside in a hospital in New York, the charged amount, like the charged amount from the hospital was $675,000. Okay. The plan paid amount was $2 million. So the bill, the itemized bill was $1.3 million less than what the plan paid. Right. And you're kind of, it's like your head scratching, like, what am I paying these carriers for?
Yeah. Right.
And so, I think we're, you know, you can be on this self-funded journey, and we were along that trajectory of, okay, cleaning up the contract, but eventually with hospital transparency and knowing what the cash price is versus what your carriers negotiated on your behalf.
Yeah.
I mean, eventually you get to the point where you're like, what am I paying you for? Why shouldn't I just pay cash prices? Like, or why shouldn't I, you know, pay cash prices with some other funding or just do direct contracting. If the middleman is not bringing value, why am I working with a middleman? I mean, that's kind of where I see this going.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Your story reminds me of, like, if you were running the federal government, I'd be sure that $1.3 million is going to fund some, like, black ops you know, prison somewhere, right? That's why you pay $20,000 for a hammer or something, right? The Pentagon, because you're right. Paying the money fund somewhere else, right?
Right.
Yeah. Give me an idea of the magnitude of the savings. So you mentioned a couple billion dollars, which, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that would have really impressed someone, but maybe now we throw around billions and trillions without even thinking much about it.
Right.
New Jersey is obviously a very big state as far as population. So what kind of savings is that for the pension benefits? And what does that mean for the state government and their budget?
Yeah, it's a really important point, right? Because as we approach now, 19.7% of GDP as a country in terms of what we're spending on healthcare, it's kind of this huge number. How do you contextualize that, right? Like, well, we spend less than 4% on education and we spend less than 1% on climate change infrastructure. Like,
right.
For the state of New Jersey, you know, we had, I believe in the, I'm trying to, you know, the budget goes up every year. But around the time, I believe it was 1 year, it was 2020, where there was, you know, well over $500 million in savings. We had a budget of close to $40 billion, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about what that can do for a state budget, for a state like New Jersey, you can actually make a full pension payment and put
down 1.5%, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's substantial, you know, and over those 3 years, it's also monies that you could then, for example, during, actually February of 22, because of the rates that we set last summer in 21, school districts across New Jersey that are participating in the school health benefits plan are getting a premium holiday. I mean, that's direct tax relief for local governments who, you know, for them, like health and benefits costs of their educators are one of the highest line items in their, you know, local budgets. So what does that mean for your municipality? It might mean better roads or, you know, better programming for what, you know, whatever the case may be. But I think at the end of the day, it's recognizing that, you know, we're spending a ton of money and we're not getting our money's worth. We're just not. And because we're not demanding it, I think. And so we need to do a better job as employers and true payers of healthcare collaborating with the providers. And I think that, again, going along that trajectory, like if there's no value proposition for the middleman, then that's got to change. Either they have to evolve and deliver value or get out of the way, because we're losing our edges from a global competitive perspective. Our health outcomes aren't improving. Our health infrastructure is, you know, crumbling, right. You know, 1 in 5 healthcare workers is quitting. We're at a crisis point, but we've said that before. And unless we do something about it, it's just going to get worse.
Of course, those middlemen have really good lobbyists. So that's one reason they stick around too, right?
Oh, yeah.
They have the best lobbyists, right? I mean, they're the biggest lobbying. I mean, the PBMs are the biggest lobbying entities in the federal government. I'm sure they are the same at the state level as well.
Yeah. I mean, they're all, you know, the hospital associations, the carriers associations, they all have very, very, you know, I find probably because I'm a lawyer and I'm sort of bookish in some ways, but I find reading the articles or the briefing on the No Surprises Act just to be fascinating, because you have these groups fighting each other over the No Surprises Act. And essentially you have the carrier saying, we have no negotiating power. Exhibit A is the craziness of hospital prices, right? And out-of-network prices. And I'm thinking to myself, you're essentially conceding in a legal document that you've signed an affidavit that you have no value proposition because you can't control prices.
Yeah.
You just said that out loud, you know? It's kind of crazy.
All right, so big value with the state government. You also mentioned the premium holiday, and for those who aren't, that just means you don't pay a premium that month or
yeah. Like so our local, participating local employers, they would typically, like, if you had 500 members, you would pay whatever the premium is, $20,000 a year times 500, and then you send that into the state as your premium. You get a month off.
Yeah, which you can use to put, like you said, any sort of other programs. All right, so what brought you into the state government? I mean, how did you get to that position? Was this a political position? Is this something you thought, oh, you know what I really want to do? I want to tackle healthcare and benefits and pensions in my state. That sounds like fun.
like everything in my career, I fell into it fortuitously, let's say. You know, I graduated from law school in 2008 at the peak of the financial crisis, when all of my colleagues that I graduated with were getting furloughed and, you know, jobs taken away. And that's why I found myself in bankruptcy, right? So I was supposed to be a construction real estate attorney, and that didn't pan out. And then, you know, when I went to the attorney general's office, I was one of the few hires that, you know, had experience. So I got to work on complex financial transactions because I, you know, had a few years under my belt. And, you know, just, you know, being smart and a hard worker, got noticed by the governor's office and some folks that I worked with on a really big, interesting project. We actually deposited the New Jersey State Lottery into the pension system. We could have a whole nother session on that. But so I got some FaceTime with some folks in the governor's office that needed somebody to step in and work with the treasurer's office and Department of Banking and Insurance. And that's where I got my FaceTime with the treasurer's office. And when I saw the, you know, just the immense opportunity and the misses and the opportunity to impact within health benefits, I thought this is something I could really sink my teeth into. You know, it's meaningful work. It's work that I tremendously enjoyed, and I just couldn't get enough. And I would, you know, listen to podcasts round the clock, just learning about all of the different facets. But I also think that, you know, my different lens coming at it, not from the carrier industry, not from the provider side, but just as somebody who thought, like, what are we paying for? Like, I ask really basic questions. But, you know, to some of our consultants and sort of legacy players, they were revolutionary questions because nobody had asked them before, despite how very straightforward and simple they were.
Yeah, I've always found those discussions interesting too. The questions we ask, I was in hospital leadership for quite a while, or at least attending the meetings. I was not in the leadership, but just the leadership within my group. And they would ask questions like, well, how do we know how much something costs? And you think to yourself, what? This is a business. How do you not know how much it costs to do something? But their model was not designed to actually take that into account. And so they had no way of even accounting and figuring that out. And it's stunning. But I'm sure you ran into that times 1,000, right? Because everything is like, well, it's just the way we've done it. And it sort of evolves. It moves a certain way. And people who are in the industry, well, that's just the way we do things. And until you go back and go to first principles and sort of ask your question, like as a customer, why are we doing it this way? And people are like, oh, I don't know. I hadn't thought about that for a long time. Just busy with managing people or whatever, right?
Or you know, there's a certain, I've definitely experienced the defensiveness, you know, when you question why something's been done a certain way and they've been doing it that way for 20 years, you know, you're in essence questioning their judgment or lack thereof. And so there is a defensiveness. So you have to hedge that with, you know, there have been changes in the market and there's reasons why things are changing. And it's not a judgment call on you. It's just, it's time to evolve. And I think, you know, if we look at where we've come from a spend perspective, there's no more, you know, there shouldn't be any need for any bigger sort of catalyst than to say, like, we have to wake up and do things differently because what we've been doing is not working.
Yeah.
If we were getting better health outcomes, if we were getting, you know, if, but we're not. Right? We're doing more of the same. We're not getting healthier and we're spending more.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, when you look at budgets for not only just the governments, but you look at even corporations, healthcare is a gigantic, you know, item where if you can save 5-10% of that budget, it's significant where you can really put the money towards salaries or whatever, providing better benefits. Maybe you spend the same amount, but get better benefits out of the deal or, you know, whatever.
Try convincing a CFO that they have a role in healthcare decisions, you know, from a benefits perspective. And they're like, no, that's HR. I don't do that. Despite the fact, like, you know, I had this argument with my husband. He's a chief commercial officer for a scrap metal company. And I say, you know, what's your health benefits plan? You have 3,000 employees. And I was like, I don't know. I'm like, but you know what non-ferrous inventory you have in Minnesota, right? But you don't know anything about this huge spend. Like, it's a problem. But there's this reluctance I feel on the part of, you know, the C-suite to say, like, they get really uncomfortable when it comes to talking about being more active in that benefits role. And I heard a great analogy. I won't take credit for it. It was a woman from Northwestern Mutual who runs their benefits. And she said, this is how she sort of had to explain the value proposition of becoming a more engaged employer to her C-suite. Let's say you have a cafeteria in your, at your headquarters, corporate headquarters, and you have a vending machine. It's a water vending machine. It's all water, 20 different types of water, right? I happen to know, because I have data and leapfrog data and all the rest, that some of the waters can be pretty dangerous and not great for you. Some of the waters are like fantastic, even good for you. And some, and all of the waters cost completely different amounts. And I know all of this. I know what they cost. I know how dangerous they are or not, but I'm not going to tell you, because it's your money. You do what you want. Just go, just go for it. Luck of the draw. And that's kind of what we do. And nobody would do that, right? Nobody would do that in healthcare. Yet we're spending way more money. And that's what we're essentially asking our employees to do, is just sort of leaving them to the wolves.
There's so much about healthcare, because it's so expensive and the price goes up, every year, whatever, people just say, well, that's just the way it is. And I think that sometimes they don't question, they're sort of not curious enough to try and tackle those problems. It's because it's a difficult, complicated problem, and everyone likes whatever the plan was, because they're worried about, it's the devil you know versus the devil you don't. One of the examples is often used as the Montana Miracle. What's her name? Marilyn Bartlett.
Marilyn.
So, right. Yeah. So she saved $30 million. Much, much smaller state, right? That's a ton for
37,000 employees. So
right, that's a ton for that small state. Just with prescription medicines, basically, right? It's just changing that, or changing, pegging prices to Medicare, I guess, with hospitals. And she was very successful. It's a model, and so a lot of people thought, hey, let's do this in our state because we can do the same thing. Well, it hasn't worked out that way in lots of states, and so. Go over why hasn't worked. Is it they just need a Marilyn Bartlett? Is it the other forces are different in the states? It's not Montana. I mean, what exactly? She was successful, and Montana's still reaping the benefits from what she did, but lots of other states have tried to replicate and have failed.
Right. So I know Marilyn well. It's a small community of health plan administrators for states.
Sure,
so
it is.
Yeah. And I think a couple of reasons for her success. Number one, she is mighty in terms of how she approached the problem. And she was really at the cutting edge of using data and CMS filings and hospital financials to really challenge the narrative that hospitals need to charge the rates that they do in order to break even or make profit. So, when they retorted with, yeah, but Medicaid and charity care and all of the things, she was able to say, yeah, but in your financial, it shows that you have a 2% Medicaid case mix, you have a 3% charity care mix, and, whatever. And you have a profit margin of 20%. So let's split the baby and you can have a profit margin of 10%, So she came at it with data. And then there was also the size, right? 37,000 members versus, closer to 1 million. And I think that the case study and how it didn't work was North Carolina. They had close to, I think they were the next up that attempted to go to full reference-based pricing in their state health plan. But, I wouldn't have wanted to be D. Jones on the other side of those hospitals, right? And Treasurer Falwell. The hospitals, they pulled out all the stops with lobbying, and quite frankly, the carrier in that instance, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, sort of sat back and said, I'm not going to help out either way. Again, once you go and you set a price directly with a hospital, what's the value proposition of the network?
Yeah, right.
Right. I think it's certainly when I joined the treasurer's office, everybody sent me the Forbes article and this article, that article. You need to do what Marilyn Bartlett did, but then I think I also know how strong the hospital lobby is in New Jersey. And the mere mention of the word direct contracting in a budget meeting once literally almost brought down the roof when the hospitals heard that, I don't think it was even in the context of something that could actually happen, but there was an immediate sort of, firestorm of direct contract. You're not thinking about this, right? Like, this isn't happening. Yeah, it would be a huge challenge. Do I think reference-based pricing is a promising solution for some? Is it the panacea? Absolutely not.
Yeah. It's and I'm sure for the hospitals, right? In some ways, she caught them off guard, right? Right? Now they read those same articles too. They're like, well, okay, we're not gonna let that happen here.
Yeah, no, Montana, exactly.
Right. So they are as once you've been fooled once, you're not gonna get fooled a second time, right? So
yes.
So you're not involved in the state government at this point, right? With the
correct pension benefits. I'm a free agent.
You're free. What would you recommend to people to get involved? I mean, someone who said, let's say someone is the same energy that they want to tackle these sorts of things in their state, or how would you recommend they go about it? I mean, is it just looking at when they get there, looking at the budget and say, okay, this is a spot, maybe for them, it won't be medications, it'll be hospitals? Or, I mean, do you have to kind of look at and see the specific situation within your state where the savings can come?
No, I mean, I think you could say, yeah, each state's going to be a little different, but by and large, it's going to be the same story everywhere, right? Hospital prices are the number one cause of hospital, the tremendous rise in healthcare costs, specialty pharmacy, huge cost driver. And I think those are probably the two big nuts to crack. How do you get involved? You know, I think that's dependent upon the political environment in your state and who's actually running the show. I happen to take the opinion, or, you know, I'm of the belief that the solution to these problems is not going to come from Washington. It is not going to come from Albany, Trenton, whatever your state capital is.
Yeah.
Absolutely, it's not. I've been there. I know how the lobbyists work. I know the political weight that can be thrown around by the legacy institutions that stand to lose from change. The change that I think change will come from the self-funded employers who finally stand up and say, like, I can't, if I'm Starbucks, I can't spend more on healthcare than coffee beans, right? yeah. It's just no longer tenable. And we will lose our place in sort of in the global competitive marketplace if we don't get a hold of this. We will. And that has to be, I think that's becoming more and more apparent. What do I think is actually going to like blow it up for there to be like real change and a real correction point that the market needs? I think there's going to be some lawsuits. I think some of the bad acting is going to be called out. And I think that some of the more recent rules and regulations, not on hospital transparency, though I think it's important, but more on the fiduciary ERISA side and some of the duties that are now being shifted and made very clear that you as an employer and a fiduciary of funds for a health plan have to do these things, right? If there's a legal obligation, a creative group of attorneys are going to get together and figure out how to use the legal system to enforce that and, you know, reap fees.
Right. We've talked about direct primary care a number of times in this show. Mm-hmm. And I know there have been people who've looked at DPC as a way of saving money. I think Indiana experimented a little bit in this. How do you see it as a role in the state government with their benefits? Is that something that can really be utilized? Because, I mean, part of me thinks, you start saying, okay, we're going to pay $75 per member per month to whoever wants to get, or let's say $100. Then all the DPC docs are going to start charging $100. Right. I mean, it's like you can or they charge $150. And now how do you get it so that it actually works? And then do you actually see any real savings and, you know, improve health outcomes by utilizing that?
So we did have a direct primary care pilot program. And for us, a pilot was probably what most would see as like a really big program. We had we had 12 locations with three different vendors. But you know, I'm not going to say it was a pilot. It was a learning opportunity. We changed the way that we contracted with the providers about 2 years in to put more funds at risk. I'm a big believer in direct primary care. I'm a big believer in tech-enabled advanced primary care within the DPC model. I think that, if you mentioned like the capitated rate, you know, not all DPC is created equally, right? So if I have a $50 per member per month and you can come whenever you want, and that's great. Or if I'm paying, like, let's say I'm paying $250 per member per month, but I'm sending all of my polychronic, you know, conditions, and I'm really taking care of those members. Like, you know, you could do the math, you know how much an ER visit costs, an avoidable ER visit. It's so worth the investment, right? And keeping folks in that care setting, as opposed to in the hospital care setting, is so important. And the way that you incentivize utilization on the member side, and then incentivize the right care on the DPC side through shared savings models, total cost of care, you know, with risk adjustments, obviously. The biggest hurdle we faced was the information embargo from the carriers, right? They don't have a vested interest in this being a successful model, right? Because they're over there on the other side of the table with the hospitals, you know, happy and fat. They don't want tech-enabled advanced primary care to keep people out of their network facilities that they've invested so much in. And they'll do everything they can to sit on the data that will truly unlock the value of that solution. It's one of the reasons where I'm sitting where I am, is because I feel so strongly in the value and importance of owning your data as a fiduciary to your plan, whether that's fully insured or self-insured.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you, your sentiment that it's not legislation. It's not going to be a top-down solution to a lot of our healthcare problems. It's going to be the individuals, and it's going to be the small businesses and the medium and larger sized businesses that recognize that they can force value in the system, right? That once there's now, I think there are definitely some solutions, and people are actively working to contract. And I think it's direct contracting aspect of it, however it might, whether it has direct primary care or other parts into it. How would you? Well, you're at 4C Health Solutions, which I'm sure part of it is going to business and saying, hey, this is how you should do things. What's your pitch to them? Like, how do you convince them that direct contracting is what they should be doing? And do you say, well, there are other companies that are doing this now, and they're saving, you know, billions of dollars because they're really big corporations. How do you convince them that this is the right way to go? This is the path forward to unlock some real big savings for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we do at 4C Health Solutions is more agnostic from a future state. Like if an employer is looking to move to direct contracting, or if they're looking to move to a DPC model, really any, you know, I would say anything other than just being straight status quo is something that we help make not just easier, but really unlock the value on, because I like to help folks visualize what they see us as. We don't necessarily reside up in the sort of the ecosystem and the periphery of digital point solutions and digital health solutions. We really sit, I think, you know, more as a utility underneath a health plan. And we help data move from a carrier like a Buca or an independent TPA or the hospital directly, you know, to the client, and then to the point solutions that they have selected. And whether that's a direct primary care vendor or, you know, an included health or whatever the quantum or accolade, whatever it is, it's taking your data and making it work for you, as opposed to working for the big carriers or working for, I mean, I've seen the monetization, and most employers aren't aware that this is happening, but their data that's running through their carriers is being sold regularly and used and being monetized in creating, you know, these products, and, you know, but you're not getting the benefit of it to drive the right health solutions for your members. And then, you know, if you are sticking with that Buca model and the traditional TPA model, you need to know where your money's going and what's being paid. Like, going back to that readjustment that we talked about in the beginning of that $1,000 claim being adjusted down to $500. In today's world, you don't know that $500 ever made it back into your account. There is no means by which you can actually account for that from a financial perspective. We do that. You know, we're very much, you know, it gets a little wonky, but we enable fiduciaries to actually have a full, you know, full view of their healthcare financial transactions and claims, which I think is really important. And I wasn't ever able to find that solution when I was at the state. You know, when you're spending $25, $30 million a day in a claim wire going out the door, and you're telling, you know, I was told, like, essentially there was no way to tie back the claim file to the financial transactions. You know, not that I'm an accountant, but Marilyn Bartlett would say, like, you know, you have to tie those things out. Money in, money out, debits and credits, right? And it seems very simple, but we don't do that in healthcare, which is crazy.
Yeah. I guess, can you explain, you mentioned the selling data, and I've heard a number of people talk about this with the data. One thing with credentialing with physicians, one of the arguments is said, well, you know, these large credentialing organizations, American Board of Medical Specialists, you know, they have, mine's ABA, there's ABP, all the different ones, that they actually sell your data. That's one of the ways they make their money, and one of the, and that the hospitals pay for this on some level.
Yeah.
I guess explain it to me, because I don't understand what they're selling and why anyone would buy it. Like, who cares if I'm credentialed? I mean, why would my hospital care? I mean, they care if I'm credentialed like once every 2 years, but outside that, I don't see what value they get for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of crazy how robust this marketplace of any data is, right? And so, for example, the health plan data for New Jersey, you know, it's all, let's say, de-identified. So there's no PHI, but they take these data sets and they'll bundle them up and sell it to, you know, some startup or even a for-profit venture capital firm that just so happens to be owned by the carrier so that they can monetize it for profit, or the hospital, that happens too. You know, when they'll create, some sort of EHR technology or a program that I've heard that, and I don't have anything to prove this, but I won't name names. But I've heard from a programmer that works in this institution that they've actually taken data and then they've gamified care pathways so that the physician is more apt to go down a care pathway that is the most profitable for the hospital system.
You mean like setting up an algorithm within the, or that making it convenient in like EMR?
Yeah, like
did you order antibiotics or did you order this test? And then it can,
right, like the care pathway that they're walked down, and, you know, gamify, whether that's behavioral psychology or the way that the app and the thing they're interacting with takes them down that path. It is purposely designed so as to take them down a path that is most profitable for the hospital, not necessarily what is most appropriate for the patient.
That's wild.
That surprises me. Knowing,
well,
I mean,
it doesn't me either, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, I just can't understand how that works, but that doesn't mean,
right,
people aren't smarter than me with the, can manipulate data that way. So that's the data that people are buying. Well, interesting. I guess I would.
Well, that's part. I mean, you know, I can think of a number, you know, when you're talking about the credentialing, you know, who knows what they're doing with it, but they'll take it and they'll bump it up against 10 other data sets and figure out some sort of product, package it up and sell it. I mean, it's one of the ways that, you know, the nonprofit hospital systems, who I'm sure you sort of see the
nonprofit.
Yeah. Yeah. well, what they'll do, right, is they'll use their nonprofit business and their physicians and their, you know, their staff within the nonprofit system, and they will incentivize creation of apps or, you know, applications or technology or whatever, and then they sell them for a really, really great price to their for-profit venture arms, who then work to monetize them and sell them. And I mean, it's, you know, the world of hospital finance and healthcare finance is just fascinating. And, but, you know, once you start to understand these things and actually like peel back the layers, I mean, a great exercise. And if you do this, if you don't do this, you should, and your listeners should listen into an earnings call on one of these for-profit, like carriers. Like, you will actually hear where, you know, you, it looks very different from the mission statement of, you know, caring for our communities and our people. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. So, Chris Deacon of 4C Health Solutions, any place people want to follow your writing or you in social media that want to?
Yeah, I'm very active on LinkedIn, and try to drop content there fairly frequently. Try to make it meaningful, so I'm not like a religious everyday poster just for the sake of posting. But also you can find my work email address on LinkedIn, or it's cdeacon@4chealthsolutions.com.
Well, thanks so much. Hopefully you've given some hope for those who want to reform governments, and also corporate entities that want to look to save money in healthcare. Thanks so much for being on The Paradox.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what The Doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.